Chapter 19. What's the difference between a Jedi Knight and a Jedi Master? Ask me in 20 years.
Jason Solo, age 15. Stars had finally come to Shedu Mod's black skies. Ben could see a thousand of them chasing one another across the night. They were flinging tiny slivers of light back and forth, erupting into orange novae and silver supernovae, falling from the sky, trailing long ribbons of flame. About 100 were descending in wild, unpredictable helixes, trying to evade a pursuing torrent of streaks and flashes. Most failed, then blossomed into a spray of color, and finished their descent in the form of dozens of brightly glowing specks. But all too often, the shooting stars swelled rapidly into the fiery-nosed lozenges of remnant dropships. They made a long, sweeping curve toward the abandoned mining complex the Jedi had been using as a base, then began to trade cannon fire with the Hapen gun emplacements hidden in the surrounding terrain. Some would make a single pass over the central compound, loosing a flurry of missiles into the already flaming buildings, then wheel around and drop into the trees. It did not seem to matter to the Imperials that most of the buildings were empty, just as they had been before the Jedi arrived, nor did it seem to matter that much of the fire they were encountering was coming from the enormous strip and pit mines adjacent to the compound. They had been given an objective to capture, and capture it they would, no matter how worthless it was or how many stormtrooper lives it cost. Once they had succeeded, Ben and the rest of the base's inhabitants would retreat even deeper into the labyrinth of tunnels, shafts, and open pits that was the mining world of Shedu Mod. The Imperial commanders would analyze the situation and assign their stormtroopers another objective, and so it would continue until one side made a mistake or simply wore down their adversaries.
"We're going to hold out," Ben said. He was standing on an old strip mining terrace,
studying the battle from inside a thicket of the gummy mabu cane that somehow thrived on this particular variety of mine-ravaged ground.
"They're not getting enough troops down to box us in."
"Well, that's a relief," said Trista,
now wearing night vision goggles and the self-camouflaging body armor of a major in Her Majesty's select commandos.
"Here I was worrying that we'd actually have to fight this thing out."
"Be nice, Trista," Terran chided.
She was also wearing night vision goggles and commando armor with an officer's insignia on the shoulders. But Ben had his doubts about whether either sister was actually in the military. While none of their fellow Hapens, even General Levette, seemed to question their right to wear the uniforms, they never saluted anyone, and no one ever saluted them.
"How's Ben supposed to know you're superstitious?"
"I'm not superstitious," Trista countered. "I'm just saying it's better not to make predictions. Nothing ever goes the way you think it will."
Terran shook her head.
"That's always been your problem. You worry too much."
She cringed as a dropship circled low overhead, a Stealth X close behind, pumping cannon bolts into its tail, then added,
"Still, I wish it was Zek telling me that."
She turned her goggles in Ben's direction.
"No offense, handsome."
"None taken," Ben said. "Zek's got a better chance of keeping up with you anyway."
Terran gave him a sly grin, then cocked her brow.
"How good a chance?"
Pretty good," Ben said. "I guess. I can't believe you're thinking about that right now."
"I can think about a lot of things at the same time,"
Terran purred.
"It's the sign of a healthy mind."
Ben felt the heat rising to his cheeks and started to turn away, until he felt a sudden jolt of shock and despair in Trista's force aura. He looked over and found her pressing her finger to her comlink earpiece, quietly murmuring into her throat mic, asking questions like,
"Do we know if she survived?"
And,
"Who's heard about this? Anyone moving yet?
Ben glanced back to Taryn and found her also holding a finger to her comlink earpiece, listening intently but not speaking. She saw him studying her and motioned him close.
There's been an attack aboard the Dragon Queen, she whispered. Almost everyone with royal blood is dead.
Ben's heart dropped so far he'd have to pick it off the ground. Tenel Ka? Taryn shook her head.
Don't know yet.
Alana? Taryn shook her head again and did not answer. The two sisters listened for another moment, then Trista clicked off. She pulled her blaster rifle from its holster and checked its power charge.
We're going to hold out, she said, quoting him. You had to say it, didn't you?
Ben frowned, struggling to make the connection between what had just happened on the Dragon Queen and the battle on Shedu Mod.
You're saying I jinxed us?
It's not your fault. This is a Hapen thing.
Taryn checked her own blaster rifle, then pointed at the lightsaber still hanging from his belt.
You do know how to use that, right?
Sure. Ben snapped the lightsaber off his belt. If I have a good...
He did not bother finishing the sentence, since both sisters had already retreated from the Mabu thicket and were heading toward an old mine adit that entered the hillside at the back of the terrace. The two guards stationed at the mouth of the tunnel took one glance at the blasters in the sisters' hands and looked away, obviously taking pains not to see the pair. Once they had entered the cool mustiness of the adit, Ben asked,
What was that all about?
The Megador still has most of the home fleet bottled up at Ouroro Station.
Trista removed her night vision goggles and led the way down the passage, following a line of hastily strung ceiling lights toward the Hapen's command center.
So it's just the Dragon Queen and a few of Dutch Arakud's battle dragons up there. Since the attack on the Queen Mother, Sigtel has been picking up a lot of comm traffic between the Anakin Solo and the Deserving Gem.
I guess that explains things.
Sort of, Ben said. Sigtel was the Hapen's signals intelligence unit. Apparently, they suspected the Moffs were trying to strike a deal with Dutch Arakud to take Tenel Ka's place.
But I was actually asking why the guards pretended not to see us.
Oh, that.
Taryn's voice turned teasing, and Ben knew he was not going to get a straight answer.
We sort of turn invisible sometimes. Don't Jedi?
It's different for us, Ben answered. We actually have to sneak.
The lights ended 1,000 meters later, next to an old repair chamber cut into one side of the adit. Once again, the guards stationed at the door looked aside as Trista and Taryn approached, and Ben followed the sisters into General Yvette's makeshift command center. About 12 senior officers, all women, of course, were gathered around a large holotable that displayed Shedu Mod's strange topography. In the center lay the main mining pit, a vine-draped abyss more than 10 kilometers wide, with a gray-green lake filling the bottom. It was surrounded by uniformly terraced hillsides cloaked in Mabu cane, and enormous flats covered with Kolg forest, old strip mines and tailings ponds slowly being reclaimed by nature. The display also showed a patchy web of red lines beneath the surface terrain. These represented what little the mapping crews had learned about the network of underground tunnels and shafts that honeycombed the area. As the officers noticed Ben and the sisters, the urgent drone that had filled the chamber quickly faded, and they turned to face the trio with expressions ranging from irritation to fear. Trista went left, and Taryn went right, leaving Ben to wonder what they wanted him to do. Deciding it would be safer to stay where he could block the door, Ben stopped at the base of the table and held the hilt of his lightsaber in plain sight. Taryn stopped about halfway down the table, positioning herself behind the officers and shaking a warning finger when one of them started to turn around. Trista marched straight to General Yvette, a stern-jawed woman who did not bother with the usual Hapen vanities, leaving her hair gray
and the old blaster burn across her cheek unaltered. Livette scowled at Trista.
You had better have a good reason for interrupting us now, especially with blasters in your hands. Don't pretend you haven't heard, Trista said,
pointing the blaster at Livette's head.
It makes you look complicit.
Livette's expression went from haughty to resigned, and feelings of guilt tainted her force aura.
Of course I've heard of the unfortunate attacks aboard the Dragon Queen, she said. The news is all over the fleet.
Trista used her free hand to point at Livette's comlink.
Open a channel to Deserving Gem, she ordered. Have the comm officer put you through to Dutch Rakud and tell us what you hear.
Livette obeyed, then suddenly looked a little ill and held the comlink out so everyone could hear. It was a woman's voice, screaming in terror and begging for her life.
There aren't going to be any deals with the Moffs, Trista said. I hope that's clear.
Absolutely.
Livette fell silent as she contemplated something. Then she smiled to herself and said,
As a matter of fact, I was just about to ask for you. We've had reports of a female Jedi penetrating our perimeter with a squad of elite guard stormtroopers.
A Jedi?
Trista asked.
With the Imperials?
That's not a Jedi, Ben said, stepping to the edge of the table. He was pretty certain that General Livette had actually authorized the penetration. But he wasn't going to argue the point if Trista and Terran didn't. Where are they? Before answering, Livette looked to Trista.
I hope you realize that nobody in this chamber was aware of Dutch Rakud's betrayal.
She was hardly smooth. Ben didn't even need the Force to tell that she was lying.
Our loyalties lie strictly with the legitimate successor to Her Majesty Tenel Ka. Assuming there is a need for a successor, of course.
Did we say something to make you believe we doubted you, General?
Terran asked coolly.
As long as we win the battle, there won't be any reason to suspect the loyalty of anyone in this room.
I'm glad we all agree.
Livette turned to one of her officers, then said,
Show them.
The officer tapped the keys of a data remote. A blue star appeared in the hollow, about a kilometer down the terrace from the headquarters, but only a few hundred meters from the underground hangar that the Jedi starfighters were using to refuel and rearm.
We believe this may be their target, the officer said, pointing at the hangar. There are reports of a hidden shaft here.
She pointed at the blue star,
that provides access to the hangar.
Trista looked to Terran.
Take Ben. I'll stay here to protect General Livette in case you run into problems.
She turned to the general again.
But I certainly hope that doesn't happen. We wouldn't want a repeat of Dutch Rakud's unfortunate accident, would we?
Livette finally paled.
It might be wise to take a squad of Her Majesty's commandos along, she said. They'll be waiting for you outside.
Ben allowed Terran to lead the way out into the attic, then stepped to her side and asked,
What happened on the Dragon Queen?
It sounds like a nana killer,
Terran answered.
The Queen took some prisoners aboard. Half an hour later, puffs of silver mist started coming out of the ventilation system, and taking down anyone with royal blood.
But everyone else is okay? Ben asked. Terran looked over.
There was a lot of royal blood on the Queen, Ben.
I know, Ben answered. But someone's got to be alive. Not everyone aboard had royal blood. So how come no one's telling us what happened to Tenel Ka? If she's dead, they ought to know it for sure.
You think Her Majesty survived?
Terran surmised.
Alana, too.
I think they could have, Ben said hopefully. Tenel Ka would have sensed trouble coming, and she's been keeping Alana very close to her. The mouth of the tunnel appeared ahead,
a black arch where the ceiling lights simply ended, and Taryn looked away.
"It's the way we do things," Taryn said. "When a queen mother dies, we like to keep things uncertain for a while. It gives us a chance to tighten up security around potential successors, and to see which one seems a little too prepared to take her place."
"Like Dutch a raccoon," Ben said. He could reach out in the Force to see if Tenelka was alive, but it would serve nothing except his curiosity, and it might be a distraction Tenelka did not need, if she was alive. "I guess that makes sense. But who's we, exactly?" Taryn did not look over.
"Who do you think, Ben?"
"I have no idea."
"Good,"
Taryn said, putting her night vision goggles back on.
"It would have been a shame to kill you."
For once, she did not sound like she was joking. Ben put on his own goggles and followed her out into the night, where they met a dozen male commandos and started down the terrace toward their intercept point. It was a difficult trip through thick stands of Mabu, especially since they had to travel quietly over broken ground. Taryn surprised Ben by setting a brutal pace in near silence, and he had to draw on the Force to match her. The commandos were quiet, but not quite silent, and when they drew within 200 meters of the objective, Taryn signaled them to slow down and move more carefully. She took Ben and continued forward, then crept into a cane thicket at the edge of the terrace and peered down into the forest. Even with the night vision goggles, it was difficult to see much through the billowing crowns of the kolg trees. About 70 meters from the base of their terrace, a troop of mangy-furred rat monkeys were huddled together on a high branch, their infrared silhouettes cowering in fear at the constant roar of Jedi starfighters entering and departing the nearby hangar. Something about the monkeys struck Ben as odd. If they were so frightened of the noise and light of the starfighters, why were they cowering in the top of the kolg tree? He began a systematic search of the nearby forest canopy, and soon spotted another troop of rat monkeys climbing into the treetops.
"There," he whispered, pointing. "Coming toward us."
Taryn ran her gaze down his arm toward the trees, then said,
"Ben, we're not looking for—"
She let her sentence trail off as she realized the significance of what he was pointing out, then glanced back into the Mabu thicket. The commandos were not yet in sight.
"What's taking them so long?" she hissed.
An unpleasant thought occurred to Ben. "You don't think they were loyal to—"
"No, they're just men."
She swung her goggles in Ben's direction.
"No offense, handsome."
Taryn slipped out of the thicket and angled down toward the point where they expected to intercept the enemy, which Ben guessed would be about where the forest met the slope. The ground was still muddy enough that he and Taryn were leaving an easy trail to follow, but the Mabu cane wasn't as thick on the embankment as it was on the flat part of the terrace, so there was a risk of being spotted on the way down. By the time Ben and Taryn reached the bottom of the slope, he could hear the soft whisper of leaves and branches rubbing against plastoid armor. He dropped behind a fallen kolg tree next to Taryn and peered out through the underbrush, hiding his presence in the Force. It was only a matter of time before Tahiri felt Taryn and the commandos, but at least she would not realize that they were accompanied by a Jedi. Fortunately, Tahiri seemed to be concentrating on other things for the moment. She emerged from the forest at the head of the column, an infrared silhouette with one hand outstretched, her palm turned downward as though feeling something rising from the ground. Behind her came a line of about a dozen stormtroopers, the four in the middle carrying a litter with a metal cone resting in the center. Ben thought the cone might be a canister full of remnant nanokiller, until he saw a set of colored lights blinking in a 3-red, 2-yellow, 1-green pattern that he had been trained to recognize early in his days as a GAG anti-terrorist operative, a Beradium warhead. Ben touched Taryn's forearm and directed her attention to the warhead, and felt her muscles tense beneath his grasp. Even a small Beradium warhead would be powerful enough to blow the top off the entire ridge, and a warhead that required four men to carry it wasn't small. Tahiri stopped about 15 meters away, in the center of a treeless circle of underbrush, and motioned the stormtrooper behind her to stop.
"I think this is it," she said. "Bring up the penetration charges, but keep that warhead back. We don't want to detonate it just trying to get into the tunnels."
The troopers carrying the warhead backed away, but the rest came forward. One of them removed his backpack and pulled a set of hollow, telescoping rods from the interior, which he extended and passed to his fellows. In the meantime, Tahiri began to wander the perimeter of the treeless circle, probing it with the force and directing the stormtroopers to drive their rods into the sandy soil about every 3 meters. As Ben watched them work, he slowly grew more outraged by the depth of the betrayal General Levette had nearly committed. Not only had she agreed to let a remnant strike team destroy the Jedi hangar, she had obviously provided them with very precise intelligence about a buried access tunnel and what they would need to open it. Even more amazingly, nobody seemed surprised or even particularly upset by the treachery. They just expected and dealt with such behavior from their loyal nobles. It was almost enough to make a sane man wonder if Kytus could be right about the galaxy needing an iron fist. Almost. After watching the stormtroopers work for a few moments, Taryn dropped to her belly and slowly began to work her blaster rifle into a gap under the Kolg tree. Realizing she intended to take a shot at Tahiri, Ben caught her arm and shook his head. He wasn't being soft-hearted. The second Taryn set the sight on her target, maybe even sooner, Tahiri's danger sense would kick in. And Ben really didn't like the idea of starting a firefight outnumbered more than 6-1. Taryn scowled and tried to pull her arm free, but relented when Ben shook his head and refused to let go. Once the stormtroopers had finished driving their poles, a second man opened his pack and began to arm and pass out the penetration charges, which his fellows inserted down the hollow rods they had driven into the sandy soil. When that was finished, the demolitions man passed a small detonator to Tahiri. She motioned for the squad to retreat, following a few steps behind. The last man had just stepped out of the circle of rods when Tahiri suddenly spun around, looking not toward Ben and Taryn, but toward the slope down which they had come a few minutes earlier.
"There's someone coming," Tahiri said, pointing.
Taryn was already rising to a knee, laying the barrel of the blaster rifle across the Kolg trunk.
"Now can I blast her?"
she whispered.
"Who's stopping you?"
Ben whispered back.
"Men."
A blue bolt screeched away from the barrel of her blaster, but Tahiri was already diving into the trees. She brought the detonator around beneath her body, pointing it toward the circle of penetration charges. Ben felt the gut-punch shockwave of an all-too-close detonation. Then his goggles went momentarily dark, as the optics were overwhelmed by the blast flash. He cowered behind the Kolg trunk with Taryn as it was pelted by falling sand and brush. In the next instant, the forest erupted into screaming bolts of blaster fire. Ben poked his head up over the tree and saw a column of sand dropping back toward the ground, and into it, where an enormous sinkhole was draining into the tunnel or shaft or whatever it was that Tahiri and her men had just opened. To the left of the sinkhole, a dozen of Tenel Ka's select commandos were charging through the trees, exchanging blaster fire with the startled Imperials. Behind it, two troopers were dragging the litter with the big Baradium warhead toward the hole, defended by the whirling blade of Tahiri's lightsaber.
"I'll take the troopers out,"
Terran said, thrusting her blaster rifle into Ben's hands.
"You keep the Jedi busy."
"She's not a..."
Ben let the sentence trail off as Terran plucked a trio of fragmentation grenades off her equipment harness and thumbed the arming switch on the first one. He propped the barrel on the tree and opened fire on Tahiri, switching from one corner of her body to another so she would have to move her blade across the greatest distance to defend herself. But Tahiri was as quick as she was precise, batting Ben's first bolts back into the tree behind which they were hiding, then deflecting them up toward the grenade that Terran had just sent arcing her way. The third bolt she deflected struck home, and the grenade detonated harmlessly above the newly reopened mineshaft. Terran thumbed the arming switches on her last two grenades.
"I said keep the Jedi busy."
Ben jumped up and began to fire, not at Tahiri, but at the Baradium warhead, forcing her to dive into position to protect the bomb. Terran sent both grenades flying across the shaft just as Tahiri dropped into a cartwheel. The Hapen whooped in delight as the maneuver carried Tahiri past the warhead and out of position to defend the troopers dragging it forward. The grenades detonated to either side of the litter, shredding the stormtroopers' armor and hurling their torn bodies aside. Tahiri was caught by the shockwave and hurled out of sight into the trees. The warhead dropped to the ground unharmed.
"Good job."
Terran took her blaster rifle back and clambered over the log.
"Now let's go finish."
She let the sentence drop and opened fire into the woods. Ben snatched up his lightsaber and jumped over the log, then saw Tahiri charging back out of the trees, bloody and battered, but still swatting Terran's blaster bolts back at her. He activated his own lightsaber and stepped forward to defend the Hapen, then watched in amazement as Tahiri deactivated her lightsaber and launched herself in a high arc toward the shaft, one hand stretching toward the warhead. "Uh-oh." Ben opened himself to the Force and reached out for the warhead, grasping for it with his mind. Saw it rising off its broken litter, starting to float toward the shaft.
"Blast!"
He raced forward, gathering himself to spring, and heard Terran calling behind him.
"Ben? Ben, wait! No!"
But Ben was already somersaulting after Tahiri, dropping down into the shaft above her. As they fell, she whirled around and brought her blade up, slashing at his neck, but not quickly enough to prevent him from blocking. He countered with a snap kick to the spine that drew a pained grunt and sent her sailing into the wall. Still falling, she came tumbling back at him, double-slashing at his midsection, then planting a boot in his ribs that drove the wind from his lungs and sent him slamming into the rocky wall. He tumbled out of control for an instant, plummeting through the darkness, then used the Force to bring himself under control. How deep was this hole? Tahiri's blade came weaving at him out of the murk, and Ben realized he had lost his night vision goggles. He blocked, blocked again, then realized he had left his stomach wide open, and still managed to get his blade down a split second before Tahiri pressed her advantage. Gasping in relief, she'd had him, but she had been too slow again. He kicked off her hip and hit the wall behind him, then used the Force to stick himself against it, hard. It was a hot, painful way to slow his descent, but it was better than the alternative. Ben saw a glow above him and looked up to see Tahiri doing the same thing on the opposite side of the shaft, a dark figure behind a bright blade, glaring down at him with bright eyes. He pressed harder, slowing his descent more, so she would not have the altitude advantage, then heard a loud splash below as the warhead reached the bottom. Water. Great. Tahiri pushed away from the wall, dropping toward him behind a wild cyclone of kicking boots and slashing blade.
It was a foolish attack. All Ben had to do was guard high, then parry and take her legs off at the knees. He raised his blade to do just that, then finally realized what he was seeing and parried without countering. Tahiri dropped past, her face not showing relief, but screwed into a mask of surprise and rage. And Ben realized that she really didn't want to kill him. Maybe she didn't even want to survive. She splashed into the water, then screamed and went silent. Ben hit half a second later, letting out his own scream as his knees were driven up to his chin. Cold, dark water poured over his head and began to rush down his throat. He coughed into the water, sucked in more water, and finally regained control of his reflexes and closed his mouth. There was water in his ears, and he could feel his hairs swirling around him, but he had no idea how far under he was. He looked up and saw steam rising past the tip of his lightsaber, so he knew he couldn't be that deep. So why wasn't he rising to the surface? Ben tried to kick himself up and immediately realized the problem. All that sandy soil that he had seen dropping into the sinkhole had to go somewhere, and now he was buried to the waist in it. Still fighting not to cough and gulp down more water, he grabbed the slick rock beside him, wiggling his legs and trying to drag himself forward, slowly opening a cavity around his hips. After a few seconds, Ben managed to pull himself free and half-scramble, half-float to the surface, where it took him a few more seconds to realize that only about half of the gasping and coughing he heard was his own. He turned and found the silhouette of Tahiri's head and shoulders about 3 meters away, her lightsaber between them, but not attacking, her free hand stretched toward a line of lights blinking in the distinctive 3 red, 2 yellow, 1 green pattern of the Beradium warhead.
"Tahiri, you don't want to do that!"
Ben tried to stand, and immediately sank back to his knees in the wet tailings.
"I know you don't, because you're no better suited to being a Sith apprentice than I was."
Tahiri glanced over, but kept her hand stretched toward the warhead.
"Stay out of it, Ben."
Her face was plunged into shadow, but he could still see her hair and eyes, both gleaming silver in the blade light reflecting off the water.
"You don't have to get hurt."
"See? That's what I mean."
Ben gave up trying to stand and simply knelt, using his shins to spread his weight across the wet pile.
"If you were Sith material, you wouldn't care whether I got hurt. You wouldn't have gotten so mad when you killed Shevu."
"I don't like killing anyone, Ben," Tahiri said.
She switched her free hand to her lightsaber, so that now she was holding it in a powerful two-handed grip.
"That doesn't mean I ever hesitate."
Ben snorted.
"You're not even a good liar."
He started to knee-walk toward the warhead.
"I'd have thought Kytus would have taught you that much."
Tahiri held her blade in front of Ben's chest.
"I'm not lying, Ben."
"Then you'll have to prove it," Ben said.
He brought his own blade up and pressed it against Tahiri's, forcing it aside.
"I'm going to go over there to take the detonator charge out of that warhead. There's only one way to stop me. And you won't do it."
Tahiri switched off her lightsaber, then switched it back on so fast that Ben barely had time to lean out of the way before the blade extended where his throat had been a moment before. But the follow-through never came, and Ben's head remained firmly attached to his shoulders.
"Close. I'll give you that."
The way Ben's heart was hammering, he felt like he might die of fear even if Tahiri didn't kill him. But he was willing to take that chance. He leaned around the blade and started knee-walking toward the warhead again.
"But not close enough. When you come back to the Order, we'll get Uncle Han to teach you a few things about bluffing."
Tahiri sighed, then switched off her blade.
I'm not coming back to the order, Ben.
The tension left Ben's body so fast that his hands began to shake uncontrollably. She was giving up.
No? Then what are you going to do? Become some kind of bounty hunter?
Ben reached the warhead and began to dig it out.
Because you know Kitus isn't going to take you back.
Yeah, but I'm done with him,
she said bitterly.
I'm done with all Solos.
Tahiri hung her lightsaber on her belt, then removed a glow rod and shined it up the water-filled tunnel.
Is anybody going to be looking for me down here? I'd rather not get killed trying to sneak away.
You won't if you help me with this,
Ben said, grunting as he struggled to turn the warhead so that he could reach the access panel.
They forgave me.
Yeah? Well, you were just a kid. And you still are.
Tahiri knelt in the water next to Ben, then used the force to spin the warhead so the access panel was facing them.
It'll be different for me.
Probably, Ben allowed. It'll take time, and you'll have to answer for your actions. But they will forgive you. I promise.
I'm not sure that promise is yours to make,
Tahiri said. Before Ben could answer, a loud splash sounded nearby, and Ben looked over to see a rope dancing next to him.
If you're going to run, you better do it now, Ben said. I'll tell them you drowned and floated away or something.
Tahiri's brow rose.
You'd lie for me.
If you want me to, Ben said. And don't worry. I'm a lot better at it than you are. That's one thing Jason taught me that I haven't forgotten yet.
Tahiri turned on the glow rod again. Her face was solemn but resolute.
I think it's time to leave the lies behind, she said. It's time to leave a lot of things behind.
For a moment, Ben wasn't sure whether she meant to come back with him, or just to get herself killed. Then a bright light began to shine down on them, and Terran's voice echoed down from above.
Move, and you're a dead woman, she warned. Ben, get away from her.
Ben looked up to see the Hapen rappelling swiftly down the shaft, holding the rope in one hand and her blaster rifle in the other.
It's okay, he called up. She's with us.
A long time ago. It is during the truce at the Battle of Ithor, and Jaina is an X-Wing pilot with the legendary Rogue Squadron. She is lying on her bunk aboard the Ral Roost, trying to get some much-needed rest before the Yuuzhan Vong renew their attack. But the bunk on the other side of the cabin is empty, and sleep won't come because of that. She has just lost her friend and wingmate, Annie Capstan, and she cannot close her eyes without seeing Annie's face. Jaina is filled with emotions she does not know how to control, and all she wants is to make them go away. The strongest is guilt. Guilt that she survived when Annie did not. Guilt that when Colonel Darklighter asked her to record a message for Annie's family, she did not even know their names. They had been flying together and bunking together for months without talking about their lives back home. Now it is too late for Jaina to ask, and that makes her feel more guilty than anything. Then the place in Jaina's heart that belongs to her brother Jason begins to warm, and she knows he is standing outside her cabin. She doesn't wait for him to knock. She simply opens the door and crawls back into her bunk, and says nothing. Jason comes and sits on the edge of her bed. He doesn't need to ask what's wrong because he knows. Because he is her twin, and he feels it too. So Jason just strokes her hair until she starts to hurt a little less, and finally falls asleep. he stays with her through the night, because he knows that if he leaves, she'll wake and won't be able to sleep again. And Jaina hears him whispering to her in her dreams, telling her that no one you love really ever has to die. Not if you don't want them to. All you have to do is hold a place for them in your heart.